All right, this is your, well, you want to make the initial pitch on it?
Okay. Everybody come in, you know, even remotely connected with tourism, convention business, everything else, agrees convention business is the very biggest moneymaker, the biggest element of the whole visitor industry. People are bigger spenders, they're, for the most part, they're on expense accounts, they're really free with their money. It's really productive of bringing bucks into the community, into the state. But to get to have conventions, you need to have convention centers. That is, in universities, you have a convention of 45 people, or 100 people, or 300 people. It can be handled just in a normal hotel. But for really money-making conventions, if we're really going to be in the convention business, as, for instance, Hawaii is, as various destinations are, you need convention centers. And the question becomes, okay, how do you pay for them? Do you expect the people who live here to pay for them, or do you try to devise a way in which the people who are actually attending the conventions, as well as visiting an area, pay for them? This is what this bill envisions is that the people who are attending the conventions themselves, who after all do put a certain burden, they're certainly a welcome burden, but they still put a burden on the community. Have to have extra policemen, extra garbage pick up, a whole bit. Let them pay for at least a substantial share of it by putting a additional tax on them. The hotel would you say that? Of course, you might say, hotel people might say, well, why us? And the reason is that, with a few exceptions, the hotel is the one place where you can catch them all.
And you said, why not you?
Yeah, right. Because if you're going to tax you're not taxing the hotel, you're taxing the guest, the visitor, the tourist. And the one place you're going to get him is at a hotel. There are some exceptions to that. But generally speaking, the one easy way to get that guy is where he has to put down his bed at night, or his head at night. Bed too, for that matter. So what this bill envisions is a statewide hotel occupancy tax, which is nothing at all unusual in the rest of the United States, and also not at all unusual in the rest of the world. They've got them on all the continents. And just to keep it simple, rather than figuring out percentages and stuff, just to keep it simple, we just put it at $1 for each night. And that would be for every hotel in the state. Now, say for instance that Fairbanks decided they wanted to create a convention center. As a matter of fact, I think we are doing just that. Under the provisions of this bill, if Fairbanks wanted to, well, first of all, then they'd borrow some money. Say it was going to cost $2 million. So they would borrow $2 million from this revolving fund, and which has a very low interest rate. I set it at 3%, figuring that's just probably enough to take care of the administration of the fund, and probably not much else. It's not supposed to be a money maker itself, but the 3% should offset the cost of the administrative fund. Okay, Fairbanks borrows $2 million, for instance, from the fund. They build a convention center. And then, the $1 that they're collecting, or if they want to, they can even raise it to $1.50. It's $1.50 per bed that's occupied in Fairbanks. That money goes to pay off Fairbanks's debt. It probably isn't sufficient to pay off the whole thing. That's true. But it would make a big bite out of it. In other words, then Fairbanks, with a little bit of money from its, or you know, a much lesser amount of money from its own resources, plus this $1.50 a night that it's getting from the tourist, it pays off the loan that it borrowed from the from the central fund. There's several ways you could do this, of course. We could just put up a convention center bill and ask the people to bond for it. But I think the weakness on that is, number one, as politicians, we have to recognize the fact it probably won't pass. It's failed before, and I think it'll fail again. Because people have the feeling, rightly or wrongly, and I think probably wrongly, but nevertheless, they have the feeling that they're paying for the convention center. And the convention center guy, the conventioneer himself, doesn't pay for it. Well, I think he probably does, but it's indirect. He pays for it in sales taxes and in payroll that his presence creates and stuff like that. But that gets awfully complicated to explain to somebody during a bond election. And I think the results of the last couple of bond elections on a subject have proved that it's just virtually impossible to prove. So I think if we're going to have convention centers, that are going to have to provide a medium by which the conventioner himself pays for the center that he's going to utilize.
What's this going to do to municipalities that already have?
Well, there's only one, but it doesn't do anything. They'll pay the dollar just like anybody else, but then they also can participate. And if they want to, for instance, they have several choices. They could obviously repeal their own head tax that they've got right now, which they may or may not want to do. They may want to build a convention center in Anchorage, which I understand there's at least two or three kind of prospects on that score. And if they do, they would be eligible to, if they wanted to, replace their present hotel occupancy tax with this dollar and a half bit and have the dollar and a half bit paid or help pay for the convention center that they're erecting. We're not saying that this is the exclusive realm of the state. As a matter of fact, we say a dollar and a half, you know, we'd go pay off the thing. Actually, if a municipality wanted to, just as they could right now, they could charge a head tax of $2, and a dollar and a half would go to pay off of it, and 50 cents would go into their own treasury, and if they wanted to, they could turn around and take that money out of the treasury and still.
This doesn't go to state. But it doesn't go into a state.
No, it goes into the revolving fund.
So, but I mean that Anchorage then would have to turn theirs over into a revolving fund, a state fund.
Well, the present tax that Anchorage has collected, it would still just go to the city of Anchorage. That's their business, you know, and as a home municipality, they've got all the right in the world to tax, over and above whatever the state might do. But if Anchorage wanted to participate, I think they would be smart to do so. They might even want to repeal their hotel occupancy tax and invoke this dollar and a half one, and have that dollar and a half one, and all that money would go into paying for Anchorage's new convention center.
But it would have to go through the state
bank, too. Let's see, how does it read? Probably does, but that's part of what the 3% is for. There might be a little bit of stuff there. But I don't know.
Well,
it's been a couple of weeks since we put off this name.
Who asked for
it? It's something I've had in mind for about the last 4 or 5 years. I've been refining the idea. Several times I've asked the ABA, this association, and isolated members of the hotel community what they would think of this sort of thing. And they have never really known what they think of it. And right at this present time, I don't think the visitor industry has taken any position on this, even though it was dropped in on the 16th. Now, I wouldn't be surprised, quite frankly, to see the visitor industry come out in opposition to it. I think what they would rather have is another bond issue. And that's fine, I don't blame them. It's, you know, looking at it from their standpoint, it's probably much more desirable. They wouldn't have to worry about the tax. They wouldn't feel like they were being singled out for a tax. The only problem is that politically, I don't think it's available to them. Even if we pass a bond issue bill, which I doubt if we will, we're going to be limited to $250 million for bonds. I think the chances of putting part of that $250 million being for convention centers is just about zero. You know, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm misreading my other colleagues, misreading you, but if we're going to be limited to $250 million and we've got such tremendous school construction bond problems and health bond problems, all the road building bond limitations, we've got at least $400 million worth of needs, and I can't see us putting convention centers ahead of those other needs. So I just don't think what the industry would prefer is reachable. And I don't think it's going to be reachable 2 years from now. So if the industry wants convention centers, and time and time again they claim that they do, and I'm a real convert to the dollar value of convention centers myself. We want that stuff, all the more valuable because it comes in the off season when tourists are not up here in great numbers. It seems to me we've got to have some way of developing a program where the business pays for itself, and this would do that.
Any community that isn't a general law or home rule city, and when they participate in the fund or not, they would still have to charge a dollar per head.
Yeah, they would, and the rationale for that is this, that conventioneers and convention business is almost as good, it's almost as good for the towns, the cities, villages surrounding the convention headquarters as it is for the village itself. This is particularly true of the convention business. People don't come to the convention, for instance, Anchorage or Juneau, and just go to Anchorage and Juneau. Conventioners are great for stopping off at Juneau on the way to Anchorage, or taking a flight up to Fort Yukon on one of those Air North charters, you know, a day or two before, a day or two after a convention in Fairbanks, or flying up to the Arctic and taking part, you know, in the an Arctic experience after a trip to Anchorage. When we had, remember last year when we had the convention of the Council of State Governments, I got it, and talked to one person after another, and it wasn't, are you going to take a trip after the convention? It's, you know, where are you going to take your trip after the convention? And got a bunch of them were plugging, you know, the ferries and everything else, and I say that facetiously because it was off season, it was great to have them there. On the way up here, others were taking ferry trips after their Anchorage convention. I talked to a whole bunch that were going over to Nome and Kotzebue. I'm sure before the convention, some of them flew out to Katmai. So that's the rationale. This is the rationale why you go ahead and charge a city that's not even doesn't even have a convention center. You charge them a dollar anyway because it's that tourist goes out there, and you're not really charging the hotel. You're charging that tourist. If the tourist doesn't go out there, then the hotel doesn't get charged for it.
Any questions or comments?
I think we have some hostile administration.
It's not all hostile.
No.
Mr. Jenkins, did you want to go up? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we both go together?
All right.
Mr. Jenkins could represent the tax side and I could comment on the funding side.
And my name is Larry Effenbach. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue responsible for the State Treasury. Mr. Jenkins is Director of Audit. We divided our response effort on this measure between the two of us. And a copy of our comments and a fiscal note prepared by Mr. Jenkins has been forwarded to you. I don't know if members of the committee have had a chance to review this. There was also a memorandum from myself, a rather rough memorandum for myself addressed to the Commissioner of Revenue outlining some comments on possible funding problems with the measure. You all received a copy of that? Why don't we divide our testimony between the tax and the Treasury side, if you will, and I'd like Mr. Jenkins to lead off and summarize his comments on some of the tax implications.
Okay. Basically, I think as Representative Miller has explained, the tax provided in this bill is fairly straightforward of a dollar per night per bed furnished for hire. And we tried to get a rough estimate of how many hotel, motel, et cetera, rooms there are in the state and came up with this 11,600 rooms. And using our 60% occupancy estimate, you can see that it would generate about $2.5 million a year, roughly. We did see, as far as the language of the law, one problem, and that is in the way it's worded in saying that it's a dollar per night per bed. And I point out the example of what could happen with that type of situation. And so our recommendation is if you were to go with this, that it be changed to room. And the only other point that we make from it's not really an administration point of view, it's more of, I guess, a philosophical point, and that is what Representative Miller has touched on earlier, and that is, it seems to be that since this is going to be levied statewide on every hotel, motel in every city in the state, that there is going to be a certain inequity created whereby an awful lot of small towns and people staying in small towns who do not benefit would be paying the tax. And I would think that you're going to get the same type of reaction that you probably got on the bond issues, where a lot of the people in the small towns said, hey, we're not going to benefit from this, why should we vote for it so that Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau can have, you know, convention centers. And so this is the only other comment that we thought of as we looked at it, is that there does seem to be that inequity built into it.
There's one other thing I considered during the vet, and I didn't rule it out. If you remember, right, the last time we had this up as a bond issue, we had it not only for convention centers, but we also allowed it for civic centers. So the smaller communities, even though they might enjoy no convention business, still might want to participate. And really, that's still not too shabby an idea. Just to keep the idea kind of clean, we went this route. But I wouldn't have any great objection if you've been in the committee and the legislature was, there would be resentment, a strong resentment in the other communities against paying for convention centers that were housed outside of those communities. I wouldn't have any objection in particular to expanding the concept to include I'm a little bit worried about whether there'd be enough money to go around, but sooner or later it might take some extra bucks from the appropriation supplement this, but that might not be the worst thing that ever happened either. So that's aside.
Mr. Chairman,
if I can interrupt this one right now, as the bill is written, those people are charged $1 a night unless it's a general law home rule city. And then they can be taxed for $1.50 if they're using the revolving fund. If they're not using the revolving fund, they're not taxed at all.
Well, they're taxed at all. Any city
unless the hotel is located.
Where are you on the
show? First section. It's levied a tax on hotels and boarding houses of $1 each night unless the hotel or boarding house is located in a general law. Then it's not taxed. So they're only taxed if they use the
I don't know why I'm lying, but I can't find the line.
It's the first section. There is levied a tax on the hotel boarding house, $1 each night, unless the hotel or boarding house is located in the city.
Yeah, with outstanding obligations to the convention centers. So you see, you charged $1 no matter where you are, unless you're a city with an obligation to the convention center fund. If you're a city with a convention center fund, you charge. Well, you can charge up to $1.50. You're still charged $1, but you can use that dollar yourself to pay off your debt service. Or you can even raise it to $1.50. Well, it may take a little bit of regrafting to make that. Richard had another question too. He wondered if the dollar was included in the $1.50 down below. And it is, except it may not be all that clear that you use.
Mr. Chairman, it's a question, since you're talking about intent. The way we read this is that on the dollar a night, this would fall to the Department of Revenue to collect. However, if the dollar and a half a night is invoked by a city, or actually this Article 6 down at the bottom of page 1 is invoked by the city, then they would actually be responsible for collecting the tax and for remitting it to the loan fund.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, that is the intent. Mr. Chairman, if I may react, I would interpret the way this is written to be only if they had a loan from the loan fund, which, of course, at this time is non-existent. So
if they chose to continue as they are,
this tax would be on. No, this tax would be on top of that.
So they'd have to pay on top of that.
That is correct.
Well, you know, may, but imagine why, for instance, Anchorage, they're planning on creating a convention center, why they wouldn't want to do this.
You get the match. This is who it is. You get a match for everything.
Well, it's not a match. You just get the dollar. You get a dollar and a half for every tourist that, in your community that stays there. And that dollar and a half goes to pay off your debt service on your convention.
I have a bill out on that this year, so I'm going to have to leave.
But if that's what you're already doing, you're collecting the dollar, then at least collect another dollar and a half for the 50 cents addition.
Yeah, they can collect up to a dollar and a half in credits. Of course, if they want to do, they can collect over and above that too, but they would do that as a separate transaction. Yeah, why don't we go ahead and...
Mr. Chairman,
I have
a few additional comments to make with respect to your bill. A few observations, though. First of all, I certainly agree with your desire to support convention centers, and I agree with your economic analysis of their value. And I also agree about perhaps the theoretically desirable way of GO debt and perhaps the problems associated with that, although I do advance that as the most desirable one. But I'd like to comment with respect to this measure on the funding side and some of the implications there, because where we disagree, I think, is on the effectiveness of this as a means of achieving your goal, which we share as a goal. To build a convention center requires a source of funds to pay the contractor up front, dollars in large volume, whereas this tax will generate a certain amount of dollars over a period of time. And if you can build convention centers for $2 million, then according to these projections, you can essentially have a convention center of that scale built every year. But that's a very small scale. It's not going to fund the 10, 15, 20, sometimes $50 million convention centers that we see being proposed. If real effort was going to be made in that direction, then a substantially different source of funding would be required. And there's the rub, because to achieve a source of funds up front, you either have to create an authority that has borrowing power, or have the state's credit rating on the line with GO debt, or somehow enhance the municipality's ability to borrow. And I think on that third point, in light of the cash flow that's coming from this tax, in light of the discussion that's already taken place in this committee, we would recommend that the financing of convention centers remain with the municipalities for those reasons. First of all, if cash flow from a tax is going to be going into a fund and going right back out of a fund to help a municipality, why should the fund exist in the first place? Why can't the fund simply revert to the municipality? That is to say, have a provision so that the municipality may wish to raise their tax and give them the right to do that, to finance convention centers, and not have the state intervene. The only alternative... Yes, sir. You certainly may.
The answer is that you need more than what the municipality can bring in. In other words, if Ketchikan or Juneau, we could tax it a dollar and a half a night at the Baron off and the other places that were blue in the face, and we still never raise enough money to even come close on this. This is why you need the dollars from all the other communities going into this deal that they can borrow from.
Well, one of the problems with borrowing from this is that it's not going to provide them enough funds to really get their convention center kicked off. It might help, in a sense, if they have additional funding, but it's not really the amount of dollars that's going to make or break this decision to build. And it has in it some sort of difficult language that makes this money, even the millions provided here, a little uncertain. For example, it provides that the legislature is authorized to annually appropriate. Well, that's sort of a moral obligation, if you will, for the legislature to appropriate in future years.
We haven't got the authority to...
To appropriate. No, you can't. But we all understand the problems with moral obligations and what might happen in the future to this state for reasons totally outside of our control or understanding. Let's say that a future legislature didn't have the power, that didn't have the dollars to appropriate. They had to go someplace else, some disaster. What if municipalities were counting on these appropriations for paying the debt of a convention center already built? There would be a certain amount of uncertainty associated with it that other bond buyers would be looking to. They'd be saying, well, yes, there's a revolving loan fund, but there's no money in it. What's really going into it is what the legislature may appropriate, but it's really up to them. So another bond buyer is saying, well, that's a moral obligation. And maybe it's worth something, maybe it isn't. But in light of what happened in New York last year, it's going to be worth a little bit less than we thought it was. So that kind of very conservative reasoning tends to decrease the value of this kind of state support. And on balance, and I recognize it's a judgmental area, and the gentleman can disagree, but in this area we think this is a less than effective way to try and have the state help. We can't easily identify a way that the state can help, and that's why we come to our sort of bottom line conclusion that if there was some way that we could enhance the municipality's right to do it directly, or ability to do it directly, I think we'd have the most effective way of achieving our common goal here, and that's the support of convention centers.
Thank you. I think the bill isn't clear, but I didn't make it clear. I think you're assuming that to pay the debt service, the money would have to come out of the revolving loan fund. And that isn't the case. The revolving loan fund would have to be built up first, and then the municipality would then borrow from it. And having borrowed from it, they then would start getting $1.50 per night per occupied room to help them pay off. But we're no longer then depending on the revolving loan fund for anything. If the legislature that very next year decides that instead of appropriating these statewide $1 nicks to they needed more for schools than they needed for the revolving loan fund, they could go ahead and do that. But that still wouldn't affect the municipality. The municipality would already have borrowed their money. They would have this $1.50 clearly earmarked for them. But they're still going to have to figure out some way to pay off the balance of the thing themselves. In other words, the state isn't picking up the whole tab anymore.
It was on that last point that I made some assumptions. I assume that because we're talking about just a little over $2 million a year, that a municipality, for example, Juneau, would be unwilling to wait 4 or 5 years until the pot got big enough, so to speak, in order to finance a substantial portion of its convention center. So it would have to seek alternative finance, and that financing would be contingent on the quality of the loan coming from this fund, the $2 million or what have you, or other loans that might be anticipated for completion or longer-term financing downstream or what have you. Let me expand that a little bit. If you have a 2-year construction cycle, not all of the financing need be in the first year. And so there might be some obligations from this loan fund expected in the second year. That's the kind of uncertainty that would exist with this moral obligation, because there may not be any cash flow into the fund the second year. If your position is that it's only that first year's amount, whatever it is, then I would certainly agree with you that there wouldn't be a risk there because then that would already be in the fund. But I'm not so sure that that would be significant. I think that would not account for more than, say, 20 or 25% of the financing needed in any community. And they would have to look to additional either contributions into that loan fund or additional sources of financing to complement those loan funds if they were going to achieve the construction of a convention center. And so I think this uncertainty is still there. We see this, you know, to sum it a little bit, we see this as an excellent attempt, but not really, I think, an effective way of getting a community which has no borrowing power today in the area of the convention center to get them to have the $10 million or $20 million cash flow. We provided here an opportunity after 3 or 4 years for them to get 20% of it, perhaps, at a low rate. But until you provide for the other 75%, you haven't got a financing package. Are we asking for the community to put up on its own ballot the other 75%?
When you're saying 75%, you're apparently talking about a $10 million facility.
Well, I suppose I am.
I think for any place outside Anchorage, your type of convention, for instance, the Ketchikan or Juneau, was the attempt to attract, I think, $4 million would probably be the trick. That's pretty handsome. I'm sure that for instance, the convention facility over there is well under $5 million.
Well,
I forget what its cost was.
Okay. Irrespective of cost going up, let's say $5 million, perfectly reasonable with a smaller configuration. It would still require some type of local bond initiative.
Oh, sure. But they figure out, say, half of it, revolving loan fund, and the other revolving fund picked up half, and the bond initiative picked up half, and then you had the dollar and a half per head coming in to help pay for that debt service, I think that would be a tremendous leg up on the problem.
Well, again, a judgmental area. We see the contradiction of on the one hand, seeing sort of a lack of success in the area of bond ballots, in particular for convention centers, and then also having a financing package contingent on their financing at least a part of it. Now, perhaps there's a kink in that curve where people are willing to finance 75% of $5 million, but not 100% of $5 million with a bond ballot.
Or half of $5
million. Yeah. Perhaps we just don't see it, and we recognize other people may. On the other side, we do see the value of having communities with this cash flow under their own control support a GO bond issue or some type of revenue bond issue or what have you that might allow them to go ahead and build the convention center without waiting the 3, 4, 5 years or whatever required to build up this loan fund. And for those principal reasons, we recognize the difficulty in financing this measure. But again, I just wanted to say that for the record and not argue further against your proposal. Thank you.
I think it's more question and answer than absolute position. For one thing, I'd like to get a copy of the fiscal note. The question that we had originally was, is the $1 an add-on to our present 5% tax?
It would be, yes.
Would be an add-on. Or could be an add-on.
Well, it could be. If you wanted to reduce your 5% tax by amount equivalent to a dollar. But in any case, we would have no... Your 5% is your own business.
Yeah.
And
okay.
$1 is mandatory.
Okay. The problem there is I just took a $150 hotel bill. Assuming that Joe Schmaltz stayed 4 days. And this is what he owes Anchorage Westward or someplace. Assuming he pays his bill as $150, round dollars, he now pays $750, or 5% of that bill. Under your system, he would pay per room, as I understand the intended amendment, which may be a man and wife, and two beds. He would pay $4. We're back down to about 50% of speed of what we're getting now. So we're ready right away. We've got to make a decision. Do we make it an add-on, or do we make an adjustment so that the funds coming in now would stay at that level? I can't answer that. I don't know what the response of the assembly might be or of the administration. But it is a question that we would have to answer because of our present tax.
My own view on the thing is that if somebody can afford to stay at the Anchorage Westward and pay $150 for 4 days, another $4 isn't going to cost them anything.
Well, that's you're going to hit him for $4, but we're hitting him for $750.
Yeah.
Now.
The rationale is probably still the same.
If we raise that to $1,150, well, we'll just have to wrestle with the aspect of add-on. But I think basically, on the surface, we were supportive of the concept. The questions I have, though, is the use of this of these proceeds. How does a municipality look at the use of those proceeds? Would it be using it as payment of debt service only? In other words, let's say Kodiak or Fairbanks. Fairbanks goes out and sells a bond issue for $30 million to build a really sizable convention center. Now, what's the debt service for $30 million per annum? Now, that's the question of this $2.5 million. How is that $2.5 going to be used? If I've got debt service of $750,000 and I can get from this fund $325,000, then it looks like it's a viable program, that it would be a beneficial program complementary to the efforts of any municipality in constructing a convention center.
Well, you couldn't get $325,000 a year out of it because the $325,000 itself is a debt.
Yeah. It's 325,000 once.
Yeah, 325,000.
The way this, and that's got back to my point. It's, there must be some way of kind of counting on future.
But of course, you wouldn't borrow 325,000. You would borrow $2 million,
capitalized
$3 million,
equivalent,
whatever. Yeah. You know, a big chunk to pay off the thing, and as I say, that would be extremely low interest, 3%, just covering the administrative overhead, and that's all. That's just to give you a great big additional boost. That's still got to be paid back. But of course, a good share of that will be paid back from the $1.50 per room.
I'd like to go back to what I think is a rather naive outlook on how much it costs to stay in a hotel. $150 for 4 nights certainly is not outlandish for the hotel. You can spend that much right here for
air. That was my bill last week, $154 for 4 nights.
That's right. Not only that, when you go in, it's taking your last penny to stay there, and it's probably the only room in town. And $4 more plus that $750 just about sinks you.
Yeah, well, $40 a head, unfortunately, is pretty well standard now. The Baranoff, the Westford, the Cook, the Travelers up in Fairbanks. And so you're talking about 160. But then you've got some other choices too in each community. You don't have to stay in the hotels. I stay at the Travel Lodge, for instance. Last time I was there was 26, 28 or something like that. You can stay at the Breakwater out here, or for that matter, the Hilton Prospector. I think are probably both a little
about
cheaper than there.
34.
Yeah. And in Fairbanks, you can, unfortunately, they burned up the one I used to stay at.
Well, we're
you have an awful lot of choice if you want to stay at a major hotel. Of course, you can always stay at a small one. So I think we are talking about a heady amount. If we're talking about Anchorage and their 5% plus another $1 per night for the revolving fund, which I haven't yet gathered what we get out of it. We get as much as $330,000.
No,
possibly to bring back in.
No, you could get as much. You could get the lump sum as much as. Whatever money happens to be available on the loan. Obviously, when this thing first gets started, there's going to be a lot of demand. Because as it points out, it's going to bring in about $2.5 million a year. And this is going to have to be kind of a policy decision, and somebody's going to have to make probably an administrative decision as to whether to let this money accumulate until it gets to be about $5 million to make one loan, and then let it accumulate again. Some federal programs do that. You just get in line. And you may, a municipality may even want to bond itself, gambling that 3 years or 5 years and hence this program will still be in existence, and then they can get in line to pay off their other loan that they got at a higher interest rate. But in any case, that's kind of the way I see it happening. If 4 or 5 years down the pike here, we're just struggling to figure out ways how to get rid of our oil money, it might very well be that we might appropriate, some additional millions of dollars into this fund, which would also be available. But it's way premature for us to be counting on that sort of thing now.
Who's going to determine the length of the loan?
Did we say here what the length was? I think I had it in mind.
I think you put a maximum on it.
I had in mind a 30-year loan, but because I figured that probably the life of the building. But,
there is no loan time.
Yeah, we should put that in there.
Now, would they be able to, say, after 15 years, go back to the office again for the 30 years?
Well, if there was enough money in the pot, you could start to talk to people into it. If the fund had grown and had $20 million in it and wasn't anybody applying for loans in that category that year, you might very well let it. Or even more realistically than that, 10 years hence, they might find the convention center that they built was a little bit too small, so they might want to, apply for an additional loan, an additional 30-year loan, for an add-on, for some additional, maybe a kitchen area or something like that that was left off the first time or whatever.
We found it administratively very difficult to consider this. You have $5 million in the fund after foregoing all requests for 5 years or 3 years or something to start. And you have three commissioners forming a commission that is going to oversee the disposition of this $5 million. And there must, if the decision is made to go ahead and let any of it go, there might easily be $50 or $75 or $100 million in loan requests. How are the priorities going to be ranked? We're talking about subjective, longer-term economic benefits. We all recognize they're there, they're real, but it's very hard to rank Fairbanks' economic benefits is greater than Juneau's or some other communities.
Well, I can't answer that, but I'll attempt to answer it by posing the same question that was asked when the federal government put out the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation put available there, and everybody says it can't work because your applications are going to so far outweigh the available, you know, money for these projects. And yet it is working because people get together and they say, hey, this year it's going to be Gnomestern for a trail out here. Next year, you know, Fairbanks gets something up there on Gina Ridge. The year after that, the program's still in existence. Juneau's going to get something up here on the Treadwell Beach deal. And that's just kind of the way it has to be. And those things do work themselves out. I'll grant you, I'm sure there's going to be more applications than there is money at first.
Well, you have a provision here that allows the Department of Commerce and Economic Development to draft regulations,
yeah,
and propose them and adopt them. Now, I assume that they could cover just about anything. So that could be handled, but any description of legislative intent, how this committee would propose to rank, would tend to help an administrative determination made later on, yeah, give it something to appeal to.
My question is, let's say Juneau wants, say, a convention center, what cost? $4 million? With the number of beds you have right here, if you tax yourself $1, keep it right here within the city, but also bond yourself, how long would it take you to pay off that loan? Less than 30 years?
I think probably, I'm just guessing now, but if we just use the dollar, I don't think we could do it in 30 years, particularly at the current interest rates. I think we'd, I don't know, I have to figure out, we've got about 40 beds.
Mike, I'd like to ask one question,
yeah,
because I initially said that we're supportive. I think we're supportive of bills and legislative attempts to assist the tourist industry and convention centers. But, you know, frankly and pragmatically, how could this bill help Anchorage?
Well, several ways. It could help you directly in the first place. If, for instance, you wanted to establish a municipal convention center, one time you had almost plans on the drawing board for it.
I've seen three plans,
yeah,
ranging from $30 million to $130 million.
Yeah, okay. But $30 million, you're probably not going to get out of this because, you know, the state's not going to wait for 10 years. And if that's the scope of the thing, if that's what you're talking about, $30 million, this may not help you, other than the fact that you may want to borrow $10 million of that from here. Or you may want to even borrow $5 million. Whatever you could get out of this fund at 3% interest, it would be a tremendous savings for the city of Anchorage. Because otherwise, if you put it on a revenue basis, you're probably going to be paying 8 or 9%. If you have it on a GO bond, you're probably going to be paying at least 6%. So you're going to save, to the extent that $5 million is valuable to you, you're going to save many hundreds of thousands of dollars on the thing. Furthermore, if you do that, to the extent that you borrowed, say, $5 million, for instance, from the fund, a dollar and a half is going to go back per bed night, or not bed night, but per room night, a dollar and a half will go in to pay off your debt service on that $5 million. So I think, I can't imagine what you're planning on building for $30 million, but that's for a convention center. Unless I'm way off on that, I think that's pretty.
That's a 20-acre proposition where they have four or five buildings, large buildings.
Yeah.
Indoor basketball and hockey and all that.
Yeah, well, that goes well beyond convention. The convention's portion itself, I think, would be considerably less than $30 million.
Sort of like
an Alaska land. An indoor Alaska land. Well, the nagging problem that still lies out there is that if Anchorage didn't build a convention center, ultimately it would be funding all the other convention centers.
Well, you'd be funding a good section of them, but believe me, from the travel industry standpoint, anytime you bring a tourist into Alaska, you're doing Anchorage a favor, because almost every tourist, I'm sure two-thirds of the tourists that come to Alaska end up in Anchorage, and that would apply to conventioners too. So if the convention center gets built up in Fairbanks, Anchorage is going to get a healthy share of the business just by being the commercial center of the state.
Who says that?
Well, every statistic I've ever seen indicates that, excluding your pure cruise ship things, I'm sure you get two-thirds. That's rough. But
my experience is two-thirds of them moved.
This could be too.
Well, I talked to Bob Garsdorf, and he's of that same opinion, that Anchorage and Fairbanks are the jump-off points, and no matter who's going where, he's got a touch in those two places, except for Southeastern, where he can go from Seattle directly to Juneau or Ketchikan, some of the smaller cities from there. But it seems to me, if a guy's going from Seattle to Fairbanks, the only thing he's going to do is drink a cup of coffee at the airport.
Well, it just kind of depends on the cell job that's been done. But if a guy's going to a convention, more and more, and this particularly applies to the big outside conventions, the type we're talking about attracting, more and more travel agents handle these, and it's the travel agent makes his money not so much as selling an airline ticket directly to Fairbanks and back, but by selling post pre-convention tours. And a post-convention tour could very well include a trip that includes the day and the night in Anchorage, then on down the Kenai Peninsula, for something like that, back for another day or night in Anchorage, and then outside, or something like that. Or it might include a trip from Fairbanks up to the Arctic, and then there's no point in coming back to Fairbanks and outside. They drop down to Anchorage, spend one day or night or something like that, or two, or whatever, to go down to Alyeska, perhaps.
Do you have any figures or anything in a report that kind of spells out some of those?
Well, Montague's got a lot of that stuff over there, although the very kind of figures you're asking for right now, a year from now, I hope we can just hand to you in a platter, because the House at least has passed just yesterday $125,000tourist study proposal that would give us some good baseline figures again. It's been better than a decade since we've really collected fresh material. We're just relying on handout type stuff from the industry, plus a little bit of in-house information that the Division of Tourism develops. But we're really embarrassingly low on real knowledge that you can really prove. It's where people spend money. But just your attendance figures down there at the log cabin, literally the hundreds of thousands of people that register down there, proves beyond any doubt that Anchorage gets better than half of all the
Big pardon?
How many beds do we have in Anchorage?
I have no idea. I really don't know.
I'm sure you've got the half
beds. But there are 11,600. We probably count for 4,000 or 5,000 at least.
Yeah, the estimate that we received was that there were slightly over 5,000 probably in Anchorage. So basically half.
In a sense, it's almost a shame that we didn't introduce this legislation 2 years ago, before Anchorage put their head and bed tax on it, because this type of thing probably would at least tend to discourage every community from taking on their own independent deals, and that makes people confusion. This is one reason why, if we're ever going to do it, probably the time is best right now, while at least only one community does have such a deal, because 5 years from now, everybody's probably going to be having a 5% or higher bed tax. And some communities, they'll use it for convention centers and tourist stuff. Other places, it'll go right into the slush fund.
I have a real question here. It seems to me that Fairbanks really has pretty much a lead in Alaska land. They certainly have some significant buildings and space, which has been helped considerably by the state, also by tourism. It would seem to me that we have 5,000 beds in Anchorage. If we were to put a dollar on it ourselves, it would be $1.5 million a year. But let's say that we could bring in that amount, and if they did it in a reasonable manner, they say put even $15 million into something, which was very adequate, and then build on later, that would only be 15 years, because otherwise it's just financing. But it would seem to me we would be far ahead to take ours as 5 cents, 5%, hang on to it, and put it into something.
Take our 5%?
Sure. And that's what part of our 5% is supposed to be for anyway.
It is going for...
It's going towards a convention center.
Well, it's...
It's not going to a convention center.
It's going to the tourism industry, and it's $120,000 this year. But that's kind of low, because we're pulling in this year over $1 million anticipated on 5%. But that's double your dollar a night.
Of course, you're still free to continue to do it, either at that rate or at a lower rate, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand we can still do all we want and build our own convention center. But I also understand that we put another bucket into the state, which goes into somebody else's convention center. I'm not greedy or anything. I'm really very philanthropic, but I just think I have to do my...
Yeah, well, I'm sure, frankly, that Anchorage would build their own at that dollar and a half. Going for the next 30 years to go into Cambridge's deal.
How long would this tax be levied from here to infinity?
Off,
or?
Until it goes off the books.
Taxes have a way of outlasting us all.
I mean, couldn't you say it's got a... Well, you can't put a life on it too well because of your 30-year amortization. Got to last. You've got to be able to cover that outstanding debt.
Actually, if you could come up with another way for us to milk the tourism, or somebody else other than just than this,
I appreciate the question and the objective.
I recognize that a hotel tax is a little difficult to administer. In the first place, you're going to be relying on the word of the innkeeper. I realize that can be a problem. You're probably not going to want to spend a small portion in auditors. Mm-hmm. So I recognize the problem. So if you can come up with any other system, I'm not wedded to just this, but I do think that if we're going to have state aid to convention centers, it's going to have to be some way that the thing generates its own money.
Yeah, and at the right time, up front, when it's needed. And short of some kind of authority that has the power to issue its own debt, which might be secured in turn by some type of moral obligation, pledge of these tax revenues. Short of that, there's not much I can see at the present time. I will examine it from that perspective, though. And I would feel more optimistic about the authority approach, except in this session we've already had proposed authorities that I think exceed $4.5 billion worth of financing.
You already got an authority, though.
We have many authorities. Yes, we do.
I mean, it's there. I don't see why Juneau, or for that matter, Fairbanks, and I think this particular bill has included Anchorage, to be able to utilize that vehicle.
Well, the Municipal Bond Bank Authority is designed to assist a municipality to issue debt at a reasonable cost. It's not intended to allow a municipality to issue debt when it otherwise could not. And in fact, it requires that the debt be perfect and in fact marketable before it'll buy it. It's attempting to give them a more perfect market, a slightly lower price, and a chance to participate under an umbrella of Alaska issues rather than a loan. And that would be particularly valuable to a smaller community that hasn't had much market experience. But it may not provide a source of $5 or $10 million in financing where the community in the past had not been able to do it on its own. It might lower the price somewhat of that financing. Let me give you an example. It might assist a community like Fairbanks or Juneau or Ketchikan finance a convention project if the community was willing to make that a general obligation of the community and not just a revenue issue. But it wouldn't necessarily help a Bethel or Seward or Dillingham. Or
it's not going to help them anywhere if they've got a bad credit rating. It's not going to help that well.
Well, that's, yeah, now we're saying the same
unless
thing.
Unless you buy insured, unless the bond issue is insured. That, I understand, has been happening. Are you saying that that Anchorage could not float a bond issue through the Municipal Bond Bank Authority for this project like this?
No, I'm not. I think Anchorage could if it wished to. I don't think Anchorage would have very much to benefit, though, so it might not wish to. It would have to be a general obligation bond issue of Anchorage. It could not be a revenue bond issue of a convention center.
GO, right.
GO. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the difference in rate varies, though. And, you know, it is conceivable that even though we might pay a little bit more, the timing is more opportune, similar to the Maine and Massachusetts bond banking.
The Vermont
experience, Maine. Vermont. Yeah. I thought you were saying that Anchorage couldn't.
I didn't mean to imply that at all. Anchorage could. It's just to state that the Municipal Bond Bank can't be a panacea, can't be a source of funds with a security value any better than the sum of the parts. And if the parts are all weak, then the total is going to be weak. Synergism doesn't work in the Municipal Bond Bank any more than it worked for some corporations in this country for a while. And the Bond Bank is just getting off now. It's going to have its first issue in May, I think, for about $3 million. And if that goes well, and we have every expectation that it will pick up steam and should be able to issue all $150 million of its total authority within the next 5 to 7 years, but it can't really be held as a panacea. It's going to have a balance of stronger credits and weaker credits in order to get revenue bond issuers to look attractively toward those issues.
My point was, and I guess still is complementary to what you're saying. If you take Fairbanks and Anchorage out of the picture, communities like Juneau and Ketchikan or Kodiak or whomever would and could benefit by using the bond bank.
Yes.
This is going to be bad. Somebody did point out that if we left out the year, I think we should be authorized for up to 30 years. If somebody, unless somebody has an objection, is there anybody else who wants to make a statement? Okay, if that's we'll consensus out then. And if it's okay with everybody, we'll just sign it now and Richard can put it planning into 30 years. Additional tax of 50 cents, comma, for a total of $1.50 total for each night that a room is occupied. And we ought to replace it. It says bed, we ought to say room, too.
You want to go to room, right?
Yeah, that was the intent. Otherwise, you're going to have a strange situation. You've got twin beds,
double beds,
triple beds.
Two people sleeping.
Yeah.
Did
you get that about 6 cents?
That's right.
Here in order to save a dollar, people may be going to town for a while.
Yeah, I'll be in until Friday morning.
Brings up another problem.
Yeah, I'm
going
to be there for lunch tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman,
all right. Hey, this has been quite a day for me. You know, I've been the majority of the speakers.
Put you down there a little bit. Mr. Chairman, question. I'd like to come back with comments on this bill. I really feel that Anchorage needs to really evaluate and analyze the bill because we don't know what the impact is. We've already got an existing tax, but we've also got things that you discussed that could be beneficial also. For instance, our collection history, what problems the state might run into versus the problems we run into. There's just a lot of things that we would like to look at and comment on.
Mr. Chairman, this being the 80th day, I'd like to keep it moving, although I can assure you that if you don't, the Finance Committee's not going to leap out of this.
Okay.
I think, finance? The areas that you want to discuss would be the financial aspects of the bill, which would be better addressed in finance.
Yeah. It's
our minority leader has a way of pushing things through in a hurry. I might add.
Your minority leader, you mean?
A majority leader. Our majority leader has a way of pushing things along.
You know what she's saying?
I think she's saying that if we may come out later on in opposition, we better get our house in order quickly.
That's what I'm saying.
Problems with it. I don't know. I can't speak right now, either pro or con for Anchorage administration or assembly, until we've evaluated it. But, and then again, I really can't until I get some guidance from.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you a bit. My only problem is, as I say, it's the 80th day, and if anything is deemed to be seriously considered, I think they almost have to be in the committee of last referral in the originating House. You know, if this was a Senate bill, we could wait for another week or two. It wouldn't matter all that much.
By this time next year, we'll have the tourism report and some other things. It wouldn't hurt you in waiting a year. Well.
I thought about a lot about this too, myself. Pass it around and tell them I can do not pass.
Yeah, that's right. What you're really doing is making it pretty hard for Anchorage legislators to come back home.
That's the intent.
Because
there's no way I'd worry about Sam. I'd be singing in the streets.
No, I think it is a shame to pass on this public history. Let me just have a chance to put people up here.
Well, it's been introduced since.
But it hasn't been brought up.
Hello? Three.
Do you want to sign on any of these other bills?
No, it's going to cost a little.
I don't know if you're not.
Sorry, but don't go away, brother.
Yeah. This is that deferred return bill. I don't think we're ready to do it or not.
Let me know tomorrow.
We didn't have a.
We'll just test them out.
We've got problems with the hospital.
Truck bars, minimum maximum not paid for the entire length of the employee. Are you familiar with that?
We were able to cost that, but there's another problem.
$544, which is.
Service credit. Sick leave is service credit.
Oh.
So you guys don't have cash for sick leave. We do. Okay, I see more. Also.
I think they're.
That doesn't mean you're fast.
And your last name was Cox?
Cox.
Sam? Okay, yeah. Well, I'll see you tomorrow then.
Okay. There's one other thing I know you need comment on. Neil was sure on this particular law I'm referring to.
Is it for return?
Okay, well, I'll bring it down. I've got costs and damn near everything.
Okay.
Time for this lady.
What I'm going to do is lean on you. Neil's costed out the sick leave thing.
Yeah, you see, that's sort of an independent thing.
It's going into the wrong section of the statutes.
I don't think there should be under the retirement statute. And they've got it under a retirement. You said it should be personnel. I was just saying.
The deal is, the unions, the election, and their they're getting everything they can through these committees. Because they're not getting it at the table.
Okay, Sam, we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. We're not trying to rush on the thing.
No, I want to support,
I'm anxious to hear Anchorage's official position too, so when you get a chance. But it'll be up there in finance.
Personally, we had to fight like hell to get that 5%. You're going to add another roughly 2%, 2.5% onto that, because I don't see us backing off on our 5%. And actually, all they have to do in Anchorage is say, well, the state legislature did that. Sorry. But it does. I don't know. I really don't know what Paul's saying.
Well, it'll be up there for a few days, maybe, or a few weeks. Maybe there a year.
See you later.
You bet. Thanks, Andy. Mr. Gates, are you going to give us words of wisdom?
I'm not sure about that.
As you can see, it doesn't have any way.
You almost got 884 out of the way. We brought that up the other day, and your hip pocket estimate turns out to be around the ballpark, 91.7, I guess. You had said about 90,000.
I think it was 90, except for the administrative expenses. You've got a copy of that now?
Yeah.
Your fiscal note? Good. Okay. Yeah.
Does anybody have any volunteers going ahead and sign that right now? State right now and is going to retire 10 years from now, he's going to get because that's what current rate is. But a guy who worked for the state a few years ago and quit and retires next month or next year or something like that, he doesn't get 2%. He gets whatever the going rate was at the time he quit, which may be 1.5% or something like that. So you've got the strange sandwich, as we were calling it, of the guy that retired some time ago. And regardless of what the income and everything and the payments were based on, he gets the 2%. The guy in the future is going to get 2%. The poor guy who just by accident quit work at the time when the thing was, say, 1.5% and hasn't retired yet, he will retire as soon as he gets to be 50 years old or 55, depending on that retirement. So this is and actually was going to that poor guy. Yeah, that poor guy. And the per total impact is about 91.7. Wow.
It's almost halfway
fine. The thrust of House Bill 643 is to attempt to raise the minimum benefits provided under both the teachers and the public employees retirement system for cost of living purposes by at least put a floor of $100 a month minimum, and then to have a percentage amount applied in depending on the relationship between the cost of living within Alaska and that outside Alaska. I've expressed some concerns on this bill before, as well as others of a similar nature, and it basically boils down to, I think, a philosophical approach, and that is, by following this trend, what we're doing is we're saying basically our retirement system, either the public employees or the teachers' retirement system, are inadequate to live in Alaska. And I think you have to make that as a number one premise in order to proceed with legislation like this. It's saying we have a 2% formula. It's based on salaries earned within Alaska. But yet, if a person continues to reside in Alaska, they should be paid something more. And from my position as administrator, I don't think that this is valid. I think a retirement system by design should be one that recognizes we are an Alaska employer, our people are presumed to remain in Alaska when they leave, but if they don't choose to live elsewhere, we shouldn't pay a greater benefit to one because of residency. We have other programs that take care of that, which are more socially oriented or economic oriented. We're looking at a trust fund here. We're looking at something where traditionally there have been provisions for cost of living for various reasons, and what you have is basically saying that our system, by its 2% formula, by its salaries earned as an active member, are inadequate to allow a member to live in Alaska. And I question that statement, if you will, or that feeling. A better approach, in my judgment, is, and in addition to this, as we've all discussed periodically, there are post-retirement pension adjustment provisions in the system, which in effect puts a double cost of living factor in. So I think rather than this type of approach, I think we have to look at the basic issues, and that is our retirement system adequate? We happen to think it is, in terms of a 2% benefit, the various other provisions that are available, and at the present time, a 10% cost of living allowance has been provided. I think a better approach might be to remove that distinction on residency and utilize the same dollars that are going into fund that to go as a partial offset towards getting into some automatic post-retirement pension adjustment. I'm just now providing you with some of my basic feelings about the subject rather than this particular bill. Or, if that isn't the way to go, we need to address, is our benefit formula adequate? Or is one thing or another, but let's look at, we require every member to pay the same rate of contribution. There's no distinction whether he intends to stay in Alaska or not. We're asking the same contribution. The employer, he's serving to the employer, presumably, the same quality of service. And as a trust fund, I think it should pay a defined, if you will, or a definite formula and not have it predicated on the fact that one may remain in the state for 6 months and get an extra $100 or $200 a month, whereas a person may well live in another area of the world. We have people living all over, is not afforded the same benefit. So based on that thinking of, is the basic formula in our system adequate? I think that's the number one question that has to be asked. And if that's not the case, well then of course something needs to be done about it. And so really I don't have any other comments to make. The sponsor of the bill is here, and I'm sure he will have remarks on it, but it's just the fact that we see it increasing the inequities, if you will, in our retirement system by going on a COLA or a residency approach.
rather than address the basic problem of perhaps too low a benefit.
If I read you right, your condition is that under this, we could get a double benefit, that in a sense, we're already paying a cost of living benefit by basing it on an Alaska salary that included an adjustment for higher costs. Is that right?
Well, as you all know, our benefits are based on average salaries during your active lifetime. And it's often said, and I believe it's true, basically salaries are geared to cost of living. So at the time of initial appointment to retirement, the person leaving active employment, his salary is at a level that presumably reflects this differential. And within Alaska, to the extent that if they happen to live in a remote area, their salaries are higher than if they live in Juneau or Anchorage, some of the others, which are, I think, the zero base, but somebody in Nome gets a higher level. And that person in themselves, their benefit is going to be based on really their sort of their geographical location of work. So up until the time of retirement, we see the formula against the current salary as being the true reflection of the benefit level that has been seen, you know, in the past to be adequate under our retirement system. And then from that point on, you do have currently cost of living provisions in, and you have a optional, or not an optional really, but a, well, not a mandatory post-retirement pension adjustment. Several adjustments have been paid over the years, but with the unfunded liabilities growing in the systems the way they have, there's really no legitimate basis that one can be granted at this point unless funding is recognized for such a benefit improvement. There has been benefit or funding appropriated to recognize this 10% COLA. And I mentioned the last time I spoke before this committee that the breakdown between the two systems on a current basis, there's roughly 60% of your public employees are living in the state and roughly 42 or 43% of your teachers. Now that may vary by as much as 4 or 5% depending on the time of the year that you take it, when people are commonly traveling, but I don't think it'll vary much more than that.
Does anybody have a question? We just got started on this when you came in on 643. I think you've probably got the rest of Mr. Gates' comments.
I was forgetting Mr. Gates' testimony. I'm going to address this more in the IRA's question. But I do have some other points that
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can just I can quickly recap just the few statements I made before. Mr. Parr, the question came up as to just the general nature of the bill, and the one main point I think that I made just prior to your arrival was one of our concern on philosophically the whole cost of living approach in that. Maybe the basic benefit structure is inadequate if it's felt that we're not, in fact, generating an adequate retirement income for a person to live in Alaska. Since they've been an employee of the state or municipality, we certainly should be designing our benefit package so without any other adjustments, at least initially, a person should be at the level needed to adequately live at whatever level is determined. And that was basically the only point I was making.
I think we've all recognized for years, Alaska, we don't keep our elderly people. Now, a lot of them go down in my part of the state, at least, not so much, I guess, you know, maybe 90, but a lot of my part of the state have to go outside and cross into the weather is too rigorous for them. Maybe they get old, they can't fight this long, but they don't want to. That, no problem. But we've also had, at least in my experience, already bonus, recognize it by limited by exempting the persons over 65 from the property tax. We passed through the House last year the exemption on the rental renters equivalent to the property tax exemption. I believe, if I'm not incorrect, they don't have to pay for hunting fishing licenses, and the university exempted anyone who wanted to take courses and pay tuition. In other words, there have been some steps taken by the state, by the legislature primarily, to make it possible for these people to stay in the state if they wish to, not to be forced to go out because of economic necessity. This bill is, in my way of thinking, in that same, takes that same approach. It makes it a little better for those who do stay in the state. It's not intended to do anything except compensate for the cost of living differential between Alaska and outside. And even there, they're put on a 25% limit, although I think we all agree, at least, again, in my part of the state, I think the usual figure used is somewhere 135% of Seattle. Anchorage, I believe, runs 119-120. Other parts of the state may run higher. I don't know. I suppose if you have to choose one figure. But I did put a limit of 25% on it because you have to have a, when you start funding this thing, you've got to know what your maximum cost is going to be. So the maximum of 25% at least to give us a parameter of which. And that, I think, is the thing. I don't know what the average retired person is getting. I did raise the question of the fiscal note because I think it showed $1.5 million for teachers and about $2.something for 2.5 million for employees. And I was afraid that might turn the committee off. And I did, Mr. Gates was kind enough to give me information of the number of teachers and number of public employees. And using my own arithmetic, which I have asked the assistant to the committee to check, I get about somewhere around 1/3. Less that amount of money. So I don't know. I did it differently. I did not do it on some kind of percentage basis. I took a number of people. I said this would give each one 15% more than they're getting now. I took an estimated average monthly retirement income and multiplied it out. And see, I get somewhat a little less than 1/3 of that personal health is on it. And if the amount of money is a factor in the committee's deliberations, I think the committee should ascertain just what the fiscal note would be. I'm wrong, fine, Mr. Gates is wrong, fine, but the committee should know what the cost would be.
Mr. Chairman, if I may make a comment, the approach Mr. Parr is taking is a pay-as-you-go funding approach, which we have consistently been opposed to. Admittedly, the dollars to go out next year are not the dollars that are shown here. The dollars that are shown here is based on an actuarial approach which accrues assets at the same time it's accruing liabilities, because we're experiencing what in absolute dollars this year, for example, there are roughly 1,000 PERS retired people, 960, 70, somewhere in there. And that will likely grow to somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 next year. We're putting on 20 to 30 to 40 people, and if 60% of those stay, the absolute dollars are increasing dramatically. By taking a percentage funding approach of payroll, you're paying, the percentage remains the same, but the dollars increase as your payrolls increase. Because the benefits, every time our employees get a benefit increase, indirectly they're getting a retirement increase because their high three average salaries are based on, or their benefit is based on salaries. So unless you take this, what you can do is in the early years on a pay-as-you-go basis, our system is virtually zero when you get into a small base. But before long, with the increases, you will get a very irregular pattern of funding. Several years down the road, you're going to be paying 1.5 times as much as as you would be otherwise. I think a good example is a fiscal note that was prepared on a bill that's in the legislature concerning our two of our three unfunded systems now, the legislator's new system and the judicial system, of which we have great concern over. The elected public officer system has 62 members. The judicial system is somewhat less than that. And so on the surface of it, if you say pay-as-you-go funding is pretty cheap. But we had it costed out, and a bill was introduced to require funding. The federal government is going to do this within the next year, so I think we have to recognize it. That, surprisingly enough, the fiscal note cost on the judicial system, which has only been in effect for a couple years, and there are only some, 36 judges, is $1.3 million next year. Versus 600,000 for the legislative system with 60 people. Now, let's take the other side of the coin. On the basis the elected public officer system is now in the law, it says it shall be paid out of annual appropriation. What was my appropriation request for next year? $75,000, including crediting interest to the members' accounts, because we don't foresee more than perhaps one person retiring next year. But we have a group of people that have liabilities, and when they go, it's going to come as a... And I'm sure the court system's judicial... That system's never been as big as the one we've just started, and already, after 5 or 6 years, their annual cost is at $1.3 million, although in no year to this point have they probably paid out benefits more than about $600,000. But if they get, again, as many judges on retirement as they have now, they're going to be way underfunded on the way that they've been going. In other words, that annual appropriation will leap in quantum leaps, whereas this same type of approach is true here. We fund our benefits as they accrue, and therefore they are trust funds, and the funds are then available. So we're in a position, if in a very hypothetical case, everything stopped tomorrow, the systems would be in a position to, right now they're not, but if they were really fully funded, they'd be adequate to pay off every last liability that went out of the system, including refunds, retirement pensions, and so forth. Last year, we saw the public employees retirement system from the state standpoint go from a fully funded basis to a deficit unfunded liability of $29 million in 1 year. This year, that doesn't include lowering to normal retirement age to age 55. I imagine our unfunded liability this year will be in excess of $50 million when that gets recognized in our next valuation. So we're in a situation where we have to, I feel, take the approach of recognizing the ultimate extremely expensive costs of our system and adequately fund them so some point down the line we're not caught in the bind where we're going in a fantasy land of saying this year's dollar cost can be made pretty cheap if all we recognize is what we're going to pay out between July and July rather than what's the liability that's accruing on 7 or 8 or 10,000 or 15,000 members. And I think, I'm sorry I got into so much length, but I think it points out, and I can appreciate what Representative Parr is saying, if you approach it, what are going to be the dollar outlays next year? If we said that on the entire retirement system, I imagine we won't pay out more than $4 or $4.5 million in PERS. Yet I figured the other day, total employee-employer inflows into our retirement system, if no legislation's passed this year, will be $42 million next year. Because the liabilities that are accruing on all of our active members are very attractive and substantial benefits. And that's the reason for this funding approach. It's consistent with every other component of our benefit structure.
Senator, you said you're concerned about the legislature. Sorry, I don't think you have to worry too much about that. That's going to get down to.
Well, no, I'm just pointing it out. Whether it does or not, we still have a judicial system to be concerned about because that's been on the books for 7 years and already we're faced with some pretty staggering costs.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, this is entirely up to you on that. I'm saying that this has been performed by our actuary that we retain, and he is a professional, and he is following consistent assumptions with what we would do for any other fiscal note. I think that perhaps I didn't make my point clear to you, Mr. Parr, is maybe the basic point that I was raising initially, maybe our basic retirement is not adequate. And if that's the case, then the way to go at it is not through COLA, but it's because it seems to me you're saying the cost of living, but I'm saying the first year somebody goes on retirement, let's say someone goes on next July, their salaries are caught up with cost of living. They're current. That's their current salary. And yet, if he remains in the state for that next month, he's going to get an extra 10% over and above that other person who paid and everything paid in the same. He isn't living in the state, so he gets 10% less. And so I think there may be a concern. I haven't seen it. I think that from the statistics that we see periodically on other systems and the formulas that are used, our 2% formula is right up with the best of the formulas you'll find nationally. Our benefit levels are likewise substantially larger because our salary scales are higher. And so when we look at, say, an average benefit of $142 in Kansas or something, their formula is less, admittedly, but their salaries are decidedly less, whereas our 2% is truly basic. What I think we're saying here, if we were basing it on the old concept of the teacher system where we only recognized so much as a maximum salary, we used to use the Southeast Senatorial District as a lid, so teachers only made contributions of $90, but it was based on their first $6,000 or $10,000 in salaries, then a COLA is very appropriate because all of their salary is not getting cranked into the formula. And that other extra salary was obviously due to cost of living differentials, but they weren't. It's sort of like Social Security. Social Security, if you make $20,000 or $50,000, you're still only paying on the first $15,100, so anybody at or above that level has a real problem when they live in Alaska because their formula is based on just a maximum salary. We had last year three or four people, according to something I saw in the paper, that made approaching 60,000, and they were range 19 employees working a lot of overtime. Well, that's going to get cranked into their retirement salary someday, and just if they work 1 or 2 years of that, they're going to walk off with one whale of a retirement salary. And I think it's difficult to look at averages or what's the low salary. This is often another point that's brought to mind. You know, what is our lowest salary? Well, I think we have to look what's behind that salary. Typically, we find the lowest salaries are those that really work the minimum number of years at a fairly low pay. We don't find people working 20 and 25 years making $150, $200 a month. If they're working a career, they're getting a salary. Oh, we see them all the way up to a couple thousand or better a month. Put one on the other day at $2,700 a month. It's an exceptional individual, but he worked 35 years with the state at a very high job. So, I mean, he is getting a large benefit, but why? He's been around a long time and he's put in a lot of service, and I'd say he's very deserving of that kind of a salary. But the person at $200-$300 typically has worked 5 years, probably has worked at another job somewhere else where they're getting another pension and Social Security or something else on top of it. So taking their total income, our benefit versus period of time worked is quite attractive, is I think the point. And if it's not, then I'd be strongly in favor of looking at the formula, basic formula itself.